from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
Our Constitution says we vote on these issues.
I'm undocumented, unafraid, and I'm here to stay.
Well, I think that's one of the few bright spots in our revenue structure recently.
Icelandic passion and dedication. Another Brexit.
My vote, I didn't think was going to matter too much because I thought we were just going to remain.
No, I'm sorry, it's a speech. What I want is a one-sentence question.
Some of this week's news out of context. This week in The Wheelhouse, we bring in Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Kalila, always good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Also with us is Matt Kaufman, investigative reporter for the Hartford Current. Hello once again, Matt.
Hi, good to be here. Thanks.
And joining us from the New Haven studios of WNPR is Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent and also grand poobah of WNHH, a great little radio station that's run by the Independent. Paul, always good to talk to you as well.
Nice to be with you, John.
And you can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live/the wheelhouse. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR The Wheelhouse. That's going to happen periodically, I suppose. First of all, though, we have to turn to some news that we weren't planning on talking about this week. We're going to turn to news from Istanbul. Another terror attack, another against a soft target. There's people waiting in lines at an airport. At least 41 people have died. More than 100 more were injured in an attack at Ataturk Airport in Istanbul. It's one of the world's busiest. The Turkish government is blaming ISIS in many ways. It's like the attack on Brussels and the airport there. It ties into a few of the other big stories of the week. But first, I'd like to get a little bit of reaction. And Kalila, you and I have been talking about this a little bit. It was noteworthy to me as I was looking for information on this bombing yesterday after it happened that unlike when something happens in the United States, there was not silence on Twitter, but there was not a whole lot of news coming through. The major news sources had information coming in about Istanbul, but we just didn't seem to care about that as much as a whole bunch of things in pop culture and certainly anything Donald Trump had to say. And I guess I'm just wondering, because we're so completely tied in together around this world and that becomes more and more obvious every day, why is that? Why do we not seem to take this as seriously as other things?
Well, I think the problem here is that we've become so desensitized. And for many people, this has become the new normal. It's also about our fundamental ignorance of what's going on around the world and understanding what happens in Istanbul is connected to what happens here in the United States. I think we all have an obligation. So, you know, I love social media to keep up on politics and affairs. But when it was a blip of, oh, there was this attack in Turkey. And by the way, Donald Trump said this. Elizabeth Warren had this to say. The kind of angst that we're feeling in the U.S., it's fundamentally tied to what leads to these attacks in Turkey and other places. That's where we have to hold people accountable.
Matt, I mean, what do you see when you see this come across our screens? Once again, it's yet another terrorist attack. Once again, we sort of have to figure out everything from how is this going to affect our lives? What does it mean to get in a plane and fly any place in the world right now? I mean, what do you see when you see 41 more people dead, three bombs blowing up at the Istanbul airport?
Curiously, I sort of wish I saw more. I mean, I think you're dead on that this doesn't have the impact of an airport bombing in Europe. I mean, Americans tend to know the Americas and Europe and see Turkey, although much of it is in Europe, as some sort of far-off, distant land. The way we treat Africa, the way we treat much of Israel and the Middle East, there's just sort of a different expectation. Well, that's where terrorism occurs. I mean, I was in Istanbul a couple of years ago, and it's a fantastic city, and it is indeed a huge airport and very busy and very important, and that is such an important geopolitical region. We should be paying a whole lot more to what is going on in Turkey, you know, internally and externally. And as Americans, we just sort of can't get past Western Europe.
Paul?
I have two feelings of confusion when I see headlines like these. One is, what do we make of just the incessant terrorist bombings that are taking place and attacks in the world? We have to have a context for them, right? And is this about repressive Muslim governments against opponent Muslim governments? Is this about the course Turkey has taken, which is an important question? It's very complicated. And also, we become numb because it happens a lot. We don't always have a context for it. I'm not sure that it's a pox on us that we see the latest headline, this 40 people were blown up, and we don't know what to make of it, or what are we supposed to sit and think? You know, I think Kalila's right. We need to delve more into the role Turkey's playing there and the fissures roiling the Muslim world and the Middle East. But yeah, I don't know. We have a whole lot to grab onto when we get a headline like that.
Well, and because it's so completely confounding, I mean, there's not clear lines, Kalilah, of who's right and who's wrong. It seems pretty clear from the style of the attack and what the Turkish government is saying that this is an ISIS attack. It feels very much in the way it was coordinated like it was. But there has been a string of attacks by the PKK, which is a Kurdish group. We in the United States are very friendly with the Kurds. They work very closely with us in places like Iraq. But in Turkey, they are seen as the enemy and they are seen as terrorists. And it becomes confusing, confounding. We don't know, much like in Syria, who the good guys are. And so it's really hard to say we're on their side.
And it's our tendency to create this us versus them dichotomy without understanding the divisions, the ethnic tensions that exist within these countries. And what other countries risk or other leaders risk by aligning with the United States? We have this expectation that everyone should fall in line with us and support us without acknowledging as everyday citizens what that means for people in the country, whether as residents or as tourists. It is really a life or death situation for them.
I want to turn to one of the issues that this sort of brings up. We were planning this week on talking quite a bit about how John Lewis from Georgia, John Larson from Connecticut teamed up to lead a sit-in on the floor of the House of Representatives in the wake of the Orlando shooting. First, let's listen to John Larson speaking with reporters in Hartford about this sit-in that they staged.
We were no longer going to stand in silence after yet another shooting and have no action be taken by the House of Representatives. After the courageous job by Chris and Dick in the Senate, and look, that vote didn't succeed either, but they got a vote. And that's all we're asking of Speaker Ryan. We don't want to block the floor of the House. We want to vote.
And, of course, he's talking there about Chris Murphy and Dick Blumenthal, the Connecticut senators who spoke and held the floor of the Senate for some 15 hours. Matt, I see this tied into what we're talking about in Istanbul today, because the key legal change the Democrats in Congress are looking for is that they just want votes on whether or not people who are on the terrorism watch list can get guns. Does this issue seem as though it's one that people who are on the gun control side of the debate in America might be able to finally make some traction on? They didn't get a vote in the Senate. They're not going to get any action in the House. But it feels as though this one is different than a ban of an assault weapon or something else that has almost no chance of passage. This one seems common sense to a lot of Americans.
Yeah, and that has nothing to do with whether or not the gun control folks are going to have success legislatively. There is, I mean, I've said this before, I don't think there's an issue in America as divisive as guns, not abortion, not immigration, not gay rights. And it cleaves people in a way that they are not interested in hearing what the other side has to say. There's no sort of talk of compromise. This does seem to an enormous number of people a fairly common sense, fairly kind of low-hanging fruit. And it doesn't matter. Some of it's a slippery slope thing. Some of it's just this enormous distrust of the other side in this. And even with what went on in Congress, with Larson saying he wants a vote. I mean, I think there's some people concerned you want the vote because you actually think there's a chance of passage, or you know there isn't and you want to embarrass the other side. And then it kind of devolves into this is our dysfunctional Congress, you know, at work or not at work again.
But embarrass the other side. But, I mean, the job is to vote on stuff. I mean, the job is to actually take votes and then let people see whether or not Congress is going to pass them. That is different than how this Congress has been working for the last several years.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And certainly we could have moved things along had the Republicans said, fine, this isn't going to pass and we'd rather not have to cast a vote on it, but let's get Congress moving again. But again, it's as easy for the conservatives to say, look, the liberals know it's not going to pass. So demanding this vote is demanding that we do something. You know, the outcome is clear. Why don't we move on to other issues that there might actually be some legislative action? So very easy for both sides to kind of retreat to the corners and say it's all your fault. I mean, you see this. You see the reaction. You know, John Lewis, frankly, you know, a personal hero of mine, I look at him at the sit-in, and I don't see politics in it. I see kind of, you know, this is John standing up for his moral conviction. And some of the others, I kind of wonder, is this a photo op? Is this, you know, so even I sort of, it's not hard for me to fall back into some cynicism or skepticism about what's really going on there. Who's really the obstructionist?
Well, you know? And we pulled this apart when I was on with Colin McEnroe talking on the nose about the Chris Murphy filibuster. You know, Kalilah, it's all for show because that's what politicians do. And that's not even a cynical thing to say. Mm-hmm. The fact is photo ops is a big part of the job. Was the fact that John Lewis was leading this something different to you in any way?
Well, I think it was definitely a strategic move to have John Lewis be the center of that photo, whether it was crafted or in sort of a natural response. To think that 50 years ago, John Lewis was on a bridge having his skull bashed in and suffering permanent damage because he was willing to stand up for something, and to then see him in really the same position on the floor of the United States House, that to me was important. And it was about saying, if you truly respect me, if you truly respect the American people, then give them a vote. It was also – I was struck by hearing Paul Ryan accuse his fellow politicians of playing politics. That's what they do. It's all theater. So whether that's a government shutdown, whether it's filibustering a vote by reading the Cat in the Hat or, you know, Jay-Z lyrics as some party leaders have done before, that's what it's all about. I think as I was watching this, I thought, you know, the campaign ads are starting to write themselves. This will appear in November. And I think Paul Ryan, other party leaders realize if we take this vote, it's going to hurt us in November because we're all focusing on the presidential election. They're concerned about those congressional elections and the state races. My hope is that what Congress could not do or would not do, states will then take up this issue because that's where we've seen the greatest progress on gun issues.
Paul?
Well, when I observed first the Murphy filibuster, which on WNHH we did filibuster weekend and we ran the thing nonstop all weekend, and the sit-in, I wondered how would I feel if it were on the other foot? Because I remember when Ted Cruz wanted to shut down the government over Obamacare, when I think about the Southern senators who filibustered over civil rights legislation, we thought that was beyond the pale because we thought that was wrong. And again, I don't think this sit-in was about getting a vote. It was about trying to stoke urgency about our madness about gun policy and the NRA stranglehold on the gun debate. So we cheer for that and we feel good. I'm not sure it has any actual impact. I mean, the most recent terrorist incidents from Daryl and Roof on, they weren't on terrorist watch lists. I don't know that. I mean, I'd love them to pass that law. I don't know if it'll have a big impact. And I also wonder philosophically whether we have a double standard, whether we on NPR and websites like mine, we love when Chris Murphy and Rosa and John Lewis raise the banner for what we believe in. And I think they're very sincere, by the way. But I think we have a double standard when we think it's okay and beyond the pale based on whether we like it, just like we like when the Supreme Court makes national policy that we think moves society forward. We think that's what they're there for. And then when they don't, or if you're on the other side of desegregation or whatever issue, you feel like they're unelected and undemocratic.
You know, it's interesting, Paul, when we did talk about the filibuster on the air, I will say I think that the Rand Paul filibuster, the Ted Cruz filibuster, these are things that interested me and probably an awful lot of Americans, too. I think there is a difference between what they were attempting to do within the last couple of years to draw attention to issues that they cared about versus the Strom Thurmond filibuster in the 1950s having to do with civil rights. That seems to be the one that is disconnected from the rest. That's one that I think at this point now, 50-some years on, most Americans can probably get behind and say, that's not the sort of filibuster and showmanship that we want to see on the floor of Congress.
I guess what I'm saying is I don't think it's really about process. I don't even think it's about legislation. It's about what we think the noble causes are and the large tectonic shifts that have to happen in American politics.
And the last thing I just wanted to say about this is that connection that I was making between the terror attacks in Istanbul yesterday. It feels to me, Kalilah, as though now that we are back to seeing airports as a place that we are concerned about. This isn't about people getting on planes because Lord knows after the course of the many years since 9/11, we take off our shoes and our belts and we do everything to screen so that what happened before doesn't happen again. This is a very different sort of thing, and it feels as though if we're going to start talking about people on terror watch lists not being able to get on planes, we may also start to think about just the entire transportation infrastructure, how soft a target it is for things like this in Istanbul, in Brussels, and frankly in any city in America as well.
And how ill-equipped we appear to be to really address these kinds of issues. And I say that as someone who is coveting my appointment for TSA pre-check because I'm thinking I have to get it.
Did you yesterday? I did.
I have one coming in 2 weeks and I'm looking forward to it because it gets to this fundamental issue of the disconnect between our feeling of needing to be first or not wanting to wait to go through a process, but then still wanting public safety. So if as a lawful gun owner, you want to be protected, you want that right to be affirmed, push for every measure you can to affirm that. And I get Paul's point about this sort of noble cause. I think the question that I raise is, what is it going to take? And if it doesn't take Sandy Hook, it doesn't take Pulse, it doesn't take Dylann Roof, then are we willing to accept that that is a change that will never come at the national level? And then do we start focusing elsewhere?
Yeah, and I think it's a change that will never come. I mean, after Sandy Hook, and again, I've said this before, there were two different responses to Sandy Hook. There was a large group of Americans who said the answer to issues like Sandy Hook is fewer guns on the streets in America. And there was another large group of Americans who said the solution to things like Sandy Hook is more guns on the streets of America. And how you ever bring those two sides together is beyond me.
The other issue that I just wanted to quickly turn to that would have led our program today, if not for the attacks in Istanbul, is tied in the same way. You know, we saw the results, Paul, of the Brexit vote, the UK voting to leave the EU. In some ways, those who voted leave might look at the problems that Turkey is having right now in controlling its borders and terror attacks against its major city and say, yeah, see, that's why we don't want to be part of this. We don't want to be so close to the problems of the eastern part of Europe. We don't want to be so close to the problems of migrants coming from Syria unchecked through Turkish borders across into Greece and other places. I guess I'm just wondering how this maybe changes the view of some people, not all certainly, about what that vote meant in the UK last week.
I think it meant, because you know, we're looking at Frexit now, France and the Netherlands and exit. I think actually the tie to the Istanbul bombing might be what you said about Kurdistan. I'm not sure if it's relevant to this one or not, but even the Islamic State, which is that we're redrawing the map of the world, and we have two human impulses at war here. And one is that toward tribalism, toward people like yourself, whether it's geographic community, religious community, ethnic community, and an interconnected world and globalization. So in the Brexit vote, you had people feel like globalization is leaving them behind. And we're having that all over the world, right? And that's in our American electorate, too. And whether that leads you to blame other people for it and outsiders, and you get the right-wing kind of Le Pen and Donald Trump and anti-immigrant fervor, or whether you believe it's clinging on to traditions that keep you strong and identified and also against globalization. So I think that's sort of what's underlining all of these events in the world, in addition with the map of the world being withdrawn. So Kurdistan, that one could argue might be a natural border that could divide up by three states. You know, since the fall of the Soviet Union, this mid-20th century world order that we had that seemed to work for a while is no longer working. And that's a sloppy process when that divides. There were artificial ways that we kept different ethnic groups, different tribal groups, different religious groups from killing each other through these artificial nations that are no longer going to exist. And then on a larger scale in EU. So I think those two competing human and social forces are at war in all these cases.
Kalila, what else do you see in the Brexit vote there? I mean, we're so attuned to want to find what's in it for us, or what does it mean to us? I know that we're talking a lot about what it actually means in the rest of the world, but we must be thinking, what does all this mean right here, too?
Well, I can say as a faculty member, I'm worried about my retirement and pension plan and what that means economically. But beyond that, I think it also means that we have to take seriously how technology and social media is changing political discourse and interaction around the world, so that the information that people were relying on about what Brexit would mean wasn't really coming from vetted, credible sources. It was about the conversations that other people were having publicly. So that has an impact on what legislators do and also how citizens engage the process.
And Matt, one of the things I wanted to just ask you about, too, is, you know, we spend so much time on our program here, and I know an awful lot of your work is about trying to figure out how to hold people accountable for the work they do leading us, right? And we're constantly watchdogging the leaders. And then every once in a while, we get to go around the leadership and we say, this is direct democracy. We get to vote on something very specific that we want. And then we see the outcome of this, including a whole bunch of people the next day having buyer's remorse and going, oh, my God, I can't believe what we did. I mean, sometimes direct democracy is a really good thing. This one seems like it wasn't played out the best way.
Well, democracy, I don't know, maybe the best form of government, the worst form, except for all the others that have been tried.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, I actually discussed this with my wife driving back from, you know, getting my global entry pass. I'm in the same way, there's some concern about the accuracy of the information coming out, you know, coming to the people of Britain. I'm not sure about the reliability of the information coming out now and the sort of regret. I mean, I know we've seen, you know, some people on the air, and I have a little bit of concern that the people sort of you know, in control of the microphones are those who might think, what an idiotic thing we just did. Let's go find people who now regret it. I don't know how widespread that is. I'm not suggesting it isn't, but I'm not quite sure. It may well be if there were another vote today, it would be about 52-48. I mean, I think there's a lot more sort of, you know, regrets it outside Britain than there may necessarily be inside. There's certainly plenty of it in the U.S. I refuse to look at my stock portfolio.
Well, I think that that's one piece of it, Paul. And we just have a minute before we've got to take a break. I think two things that people woke up to the next morning when they didn't think that this was actually going to happen, and we heard how the U.K. voted, the first thing many of us thought about was, oh, my goodness, this can't be good for global markets. Boy, I hope my folks who are going to retire soon have it all socked away. And then there's the other thing, which is, does this say anything about U.S. politics? I mean, an awful lot of commentators right away said, see, this is exactly the same as Donald Trump. Many others have said, no, this isn't nothing like Donald Trump. What do you see here, Paul?
I think every nation's elector is different, but what's the common thread is this pull of how do we adapt to globalization and interconnectedness versus the pull toward either wanting a past that no longer exists in our ability to earn a standard of living, or where we are regionally as one people. So yeah, I do think there are connections. I don't think it's the exact same, but I love Matt's point. Since we started in journalism, it used to be that you had to find three people to call something a trend. Now you have to find one and a half.
Right.
I think you go out and you find three people to talk, it means nothing.
Kalila, a quick thought. I mean, do we draw any Donald Trump comparisons at all to his success and the success of the Brexit vote?
I think what is the common theme there is fear. So whether we see it as legitimate or illegitimate, fear is such a powerful motivating force in politics. And instead of focusing on the leaders or those who are promoting that fear, we have to look at the fear of why people believe the way they do.
We're talking today with Kalila Brown-Dean, an associate professor of political science at Quinnipiac University, Paul Bass, the editor of the New Haven Independent, Matt Kaufman, investigative reporter for the Hartford Current. Colin McEnroe is taking the week off. When we come back, we're going to be talking about some interesting rulings from the Supreme Court this week. They're kind of all over the place, and it provides us a lot to talk about here on The Wheelhouse on WNPR. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Colin McEnroe is off this week. Hope he's having a nice week of vacation. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on The Colin McEnroe Show, we're rerunning a favorite program. It's called Adrenaline, America's Favorite Hormone. We say our modern lifestyle runs on adrenaline. Some of us claim to be adrenaline junkies, but what exactly is it? And does it work the way we think it does? That's this afternoon at 1 o'clock on The Colin McEnroe Show. Sitting ably in for Colin today is Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Paul Bass is here. He's in our New Haven studios. He's editor of the New Haven Independent. And Matt Kaufman is an investigative reporter for the Hartford Current. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse. A lot of interesting rulings came down from the U.S. Supreme Court this week. And let's just go through some of them, because I know that there's a lot to talk about in many. We were talking about guns earlier. They did rule at the Supreme Court that people convicted of misdemeanor domestic abuse can be banned from owning guns. You know, given some of the problems, Kalila, of gridlock in Congress, could gun control advocates be making more strides in the courts like this, do you think?
I think we're going to see a lot more lawsuits, a lot more people on both sides of the issue really pushing the court to make a definitive decision, much the same way when we talked about marriage equality, of states saying, make a decision so that we can do this and move on, same with immigration. So I think this was an important decision.
Any thoughts, Paul, on the abortion ruling in Texas? Now, this is something really interesting. The court strikes down these abortion restrictions in Texas. What Texas was attempting to do is make abortion clinics much more like hospitals, surgical clinics. This was seen by many people, certainly abortion rights supporters, as a red herring. It wasn't about women's health in their minds. It was actually about trying to make it much harder to have an abortion. What does this say about the court, and what does this say about the abortion conversation in America right now?
I think the abortion conversation has always been mischaracterized by the right. I think people are very much on the left center of the issue. I think this is Kennedy's court, and this shows over and over, this Anthony Kennedy's court. And it's interesting to watch what happens to people when they're on the court for a while. It was Richard Nixon's appointees, or even the first George Bush's appointees, or even the other direction, that terrible decision Breyer joined the other day about searches, you know, using evidence obtained in illegal searches. And I think they kind of gravitate toward the middle in some cases, and And I think that's what we've seen.
One of the cases that was interesting to us, just because we've had so darn many of these, is this public corruption case, Matt. The former Virginia governor has his conviction overturned. It's seen as a kind of a narrow ruling, but it is also, I think, has a lot of people who investigate civic corruption perhaps a little bit worried about how things like a conviction of, a governor for taking bribes might stick.
Yeah. Well, I completely disagree with you when you say it has people a little bit worried. the court seemed to say, look, you know, the way the law is written, there needs to be sort of specific action on the part of a politician in order for it to be illegal to, you know, pocket Rolexes and the like. If they are indeed correct, then our gridlocked Congress maybe needs to address that. I mean, if the court was saying we're stuck with law, as you know, non-activist courts are, we're stuck with the laws the legislature, the Congress has given us. If that indeed is the case, then, you know, folks at Common Cause and the like need to start lobbying for changes in the law. But it's certainly disheartening for, you know, good government people, accountability people, to see a situation in which, you know, if you can't kind of prove direct action, because again, it's not just a matter of, you know, there's a quid and a quo.
Yeah.
In order to sustain a conviction, then you would have to prove that there was and that there's a connection between them. And that is just way too high a bar. I mean, it shouldn't be that difficult to have a society that says, if you are in government, if you have that sort of enormous power, you are an employee, a servant of the people, you cannot take gifts in large sums, you know, that the average person would see as an effort to change anything, you know, access anything. Now, frankly, you can make the same argument about campaign finance. There are probably some saying, how is that all that different? The answer, of course, is it's not
at all. Well, I wonder if part of the issue is that just this particular case, that this is a bad case, or that this is a case of overreach that shouldn't be the one that sets the standard for all the other public corruption that you encounter on a regular basis.
Yeah, I may set the standard lower than some. I mean, this may not have been, you know, the perfect case, but to me, this would not have been a difficult case. And the Supreme Court doesn't use the smell test, this one certainly doesn't pass that test.
Well, as a Virginia native, you know, a lot of people back home are wondering what's next. And so how long will it take for him to come back into politics, as we've seen in other states like Connecticut? But what will happen in the interim? So is there a reality show, a memoir, what's in the works for him? He's been very clear from the start that even if this charge, you know, were to stick, he still felt like he would be a public servant and serve the people, not just of Virginia, but of the country. So it'll be an interesting few years.
Yeah, I mean, it's troubling that he would find this acceptable, that there isn't a sense of, okay, you know what, I went too far, mm-hmm. and now that I look back on it. But when politicians double down on bad behavior, that's sort of doubly troubling.
But of course, Matt is asking for the Congress to do something about this. I don't know if necessarily there's going to be any legal change forthcoming to sort of make this all quite a bit clearer.
No, I'm not counting on it.
Yeah. Nor am I.
I would think not. President Obama's order on immigration is struck down. From the New York Times, they write, 4 million to 5 million people who might have been spared deportation remain stranded, vulnerable to arrest, and unable to work legally. Mr. Obama, the Times goes on, wanted to give temporary protection to unauthorized immigrants whose children are citizens or legal residents and whose clean records made them very low priorities for deportation. This ruling at the court kicked off protests in several cities, including here in Hartford.
El pueblo unido jamás será vencido. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
So Paul Bass, what do you see in this? Obviously, there's protests going on all over. Immigration and issues of legal immigration have been huge in your area, in New Haven and in East Haven, over the course of the last decade or so.
Yeah, and that's what's made our community so much stronger over the last decade. We've had another round that we had from a century earlier of just making our city safer and stronger and a better place to live because of all the immigration. I think what the ruling showed is how much is at stake in the presidential election, that it's almost all about the Supreme Court and the Justice Department, and that it's stark there. I don't think Congress is able to deal with the immigration issue, that where the fix really needs to happen. And so I think it's going to be determined by which president gets to pick the next, and not just this issue, many other issues, the next Supreme Court justice.
Kalila?
Well, I'm also thinking about what the collateral consequences of this will be. Will we see increased instability of children who have to go into foster care because their parents are now eligible for deportation if we have a new president who actively enforces some of those policies. And to be clear, Obama authorized a lot of deportation. So to think about what that will mean in a different direction, how this will impact our communities, our neighborhoods, beyond those who are here in an undocumented status. That's why this decision is so key, is because it affects stability for all of our cities and really across the country.
Yeah, I mean, the divide in the court sort of, I think, accurately reflects the divide in the country. If there's one thing, you know, all sides agree on is we have this quote-unquote broken immigration system, and we don't I don't know how close we are to getting anywhere on it, because we can't really kind of agree on what the goals are. And I think there's a lot of kind of bad faith and mistrust on that. And this brings up, you know, a lot of the sort of uglier side of Americanism, of what's really at the heart of some of the concerns, sort of the unspoken concerns. So I completely agree that this is something that will be left to the courts. It's, you know, wide enough open that it wouldn't be outrageous to rule one way or the other. And the Ninth Justice will probably decide America's immigration policy.
And Paul, I just have to ask about this. I mean, it's something that we bring up, and trying to not make too much potentially of what the Donald Trump campaign has meant to America. But it almost seems as though the rhetoric that he's used and that some of his supporters have engaged in has reset the bar on what our immigration debate is. Not so terribly long ago, you had Republican senators who were trying to figure out what side of this issue they were on. The question really seemed to be, what's the best way to deal with the fact that we have tens of millions of undocumented immigrants in our country, and make sure that we, in a reasonable way, allow many of them to become citizens, many of them to stay here and work, et cetera, et cetera. That was the conversation a couple years ago. Now the conversation seems to be set in a different place, in which there's an awful lot more public animus toward any immigration at all and toward the people who are already here doing jobs that people need to have done in America.
Not that long ago, our economy was in much better shape. I think in American history, we have waves in which people are feeling economic stress, and then nativist politicians and demagogues, whether it was Father Coughlin in the past or today's era, make us turn on people who aren't really the cause of the problem, in this case, immigrants. And I think that's why the debate, I think Donald Trump himself thought he had only a 10% chance of becoming president. I think he's a fact. His emergence is a factor of the times we're living in, when people are feeling the stress. You have nativist populist speakers who can advance by playing to their hatreds and their prejudices. And I think immigrants have always borne the brunt of that in American history.
The one last case that we wanted to talk about, though, Kalilah, is that the Texas law having to do with affirmative action. So this is something that we've talked about, I think, a little bit in the past. And affirmative action has not been something, of all the issues that have been talked about an awful lot that have to do with race or class or have come up around immigration over the course of the last year or so, we haven't spent a whole lot of time talking about affirmative action issues. And the fact that the court upholds this law is something meaningful.
Well, I think what is coming through in this election is this idea that there are certain groups who are making illegitimate demands on a system, on institutions. And so it's particularly important talking about gender in the context of affirmative action. So whether that is saying that young men are underrepresented on college campuses, and so you need to take affirmative steps to include their representation, or thinking about legacy status and how by no effort of your own other than being born into a particular family, you have a privileged position over others who do not share that. I think this is important for what we're seeing, the type of unrest that we see on college campuses across the country. What happened in Missouri was people feeling like by speaking up and speaking out, people were making illegitimate demands. So to now have the Supreme Court say, yes, we are not where we need to be as a nation, as a higher education system, what will be the impact on college campuses around the country? Because that's where we see what's happening in the nation.
The legacy thing, I think, is fascinating. You don't see a lot of irritation and frustration, protesting over that issue, or the fact that, someone from Wyoming gets into an East Coast campus because the college thinks, you know what, we are a better community for having that sort of diversity. And so the Supreme Court really certainly does – it's an important ruling for affirmative action advocates in that it does kind of solidify, even without, you know, being in over the head of it, that that is a valuable thing, that diversity is valuable and legal, that affirmative action is legal. And so the question is, how should schools implement it? And they kind of punt it back to the schools. And in some ways, you know, it often feels like sort of shirking responsibility when you say, well, we don't want to decide the parameters. But when you say this is legal if it advances a specific, you know, demonstrable cause, we're not really the experts on that, and we probably should leave it to school administrators to do that. So there's sort of a lot of sensibility in that decision.
It was interesting to me, the contrast between that decision and the one I keep coming back to about the Fourth Amendment search and seizure decision, which is the decision that really blew me away in this session. And the most powerful opinion, I thought, was Sonia Sotomayor's dissent in that case, which is that we've just had this national – we might not have been talking about affirmative action, but we were talking about debtor's prison and police mistreatment of blacks and Latinos all over the country and what that means for their daily lives. And Sonia Sotomayor wrote about how the court seemed to be deaf to that when they said that it's okay if you racially profile someone, stop them for no reason, go fishing for warrants and they owe a parking ticket or parking tickets that makes it a warrant, and then you can see stuff in their car and use it as evidence. She said that reflected to say that that's okay means that you have checked out of what is the most important racial debate we've had in this country in years. And I thought that was powerful, and I was surprised there wasn't more talk about that.
And it seems so incongruent with all of the discussion about the no-fly list and due process. If we're concerned about due process for people who can't fly or, you know, may have their rights to own a gun concerned, we should be upset that Freddie Gray, the same day that these Supreme Court decisions are coming out, had been denied due process. And it doesn't look like anyone will be held responsible for that either.
Kalila Brown, Dean from Quinnipiac University, Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent, Matt Kaufman from the Hartford Current. They're all here in the wheelhouse today. Colin McEnroe has the week off. When we come back, we're going to talk about a few local stories, one having to do with a scandal over a soccer stadium, the other one having to do with an overdose crisis in New Haven. We'll be right back. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow on Where We Live with Lucy Nalpathanchil, minor league baseball's Eastern League has its all-star game in 2 weeks. Fortunately, that game is not scheduled to be held in Hartford, where the baseball stadium is partially complete and nothing more. Lucy will talk with Hartford Mayor Luke Bronin and other officials involved in the stadium process and where things stand with this minor league ballpark. That's tomorrow on Where We Live. Today in The Wheelhouse, we're talking with Kalila Brown-Dean from Quinnipiac University, Paul Bass from the New Haven Independent, and Matt Kaufman from the Hartford Current about a lot of things, including, hey, Matt, since we're talking about stadiums, at the beginning of the segment here, I mentioned that we're going to be talking about the Hartford Baseball Stadium. There's a new development in the Hartford Stadium debacle that you've been covering. The former developers of Dillon Stadium, the soccer stadium, were indicted on charges of defrauding the city. Bring us up to date on this, Matt.
Right. So Dillon Stadium, great little soccer field in Hartford. The city wanted to redevelop it, had a contract to do that. And a businessman from Summers came forward and said, look, I'll make you a deal. You give me a couple million dollars to pay for clearing the site. I'll build you a $30, $40, maybe $50 million stadium without any public money. The city found that incredibly enticing, turned over about $1.8 million, and was not very careful about where that money was actually going. There were a number of invoices, hundreds of thousands, actually over $1 million worth of invoices submitted to the city on behalf of subcontractors for work that was never actually done. And that money never actually made it to those subcontractors. And instead, the federal government now alleges went into the pockets of the two developers. So they're facing a number of counts of basically taking money from the city and diverting it into their own pockets.
And when you say the city found that enticing, they found it enticing in the way it's enticing when someone calls you down from a dark alley and says, hey, John, come down here. I've got a lot of money for you. Please, please. Don't, I'm sure it's safe. That's sort of what it feels like.
Or I've got a lottery ticket, but I can't cash it in and give me couple hundred bucks. And
yeah.
You know,
or so. I am a prince from Nigeria and please read my email, right, et cetera. Right. I mean, it's hard to believe with the other stadium debacle going on, having to do with this baseball stadium, which in many ways is incredibly poorly handled, but is above board in the sense of we sort of saw what the process was. This process seems entirely different and ludicrous in just how unbelievable that deal could have been. How does the city get into a deal in which you're going to have a developer do this without any real way of proving that he'd have the ability to do it?
Yeah, I mean, well, he did submit documents allegedly showing he had $440 million available to him from Barclays. The government alleges those documents were fraudulent. They didn't kind of dot their I's there. I mean, they particularly in the development office, the director of development, the project manager, both forced out, received enormous invoices and did very little vetting to determine whether those were legitimate. And it's unclear if indeed the allegations are correct and that this was a fraudulent enterprise. It's unclear sort of when that turned. You know, the initial contract before the Summers businessman came in, the city was going to pay $12 million. That seemed to be going along legitimately. We haven't found any evidence to the contrary. And at some point, something changed. I don't know. It may turn out to be that classic thing of, you know, I'm just borrowing this money till this other investor money comes in. And the classic thing of it'll all work out as long as it all works out. And in this case, it clearly did not.
I will say, Paul, that the reason for these indictments, the reason that we're talking about this right now is because of the great work that Matt and his colleague Jenna Carlesso and others at the Hartford Current did. And it just – I think it speaks once again, Paul, to the fact that we've got a real job to do in watching city governments and other governments in terms of how they spend our money.
I also think that there's been this illusion that building sports stadiums revive your cities. I mean, we've disproved that in Connecticut. They're for two reasons. They're terrible ideas. Yeah, this home run economic development, whether it's convention centers or stadiums, they're always boondoggles. Even if they weren't, that's not how you build a city that people want to live in that are vibrant, but it's the nuts and bolts of good schools and strong neighborhoods and public safety and drawing on your inherent strengths like we did in New Haven with the culture of our city and immigration. So that's one reason. The other is that those deals are always funny money. So I think anytime you're changing a sports stadium, you lose.
I just think Hartford needs a win. So I felt the same way when the Cavs won the NBA championship. So between this stadium debacle, the Yard Goats, and now no fireworks, I think the people of Hartford need a really good win. So I haven't figured out what that is yet. But I think it is also in all of our discussion about the Second Amendment and how divided we are over that. I think that the work that Matt and Paul and John and others are doing affirms why we need to protect the First Amendment. Now more than ever, when we see these corruption cases, these bad deals, this is why you need a press that will ask those difficult stories. How else would we get access to that?
Paul, and I have to, unfortunately, ending on a really sad note on this show, but I have to ask you about the story that you've been covering this week, just a rash of overdoses. 16 people overdosed on drugs laced with fentanyl, now perhaps pure fentanyl. People have died. What has been happening around this in New Haven, and why is this different than some of the other overdose crises that we've seen around the region in the last year or so?
This is different. So it was last Thursday. In 6 hours, 15 people overdosed, two fatally, and then overall 17 and three fatally from one batch of drugs. So at first, authorities said it was definitely heroin laced with fentanyl because that's a trend around the country. People get addicted to opioids, they go to heroin. Then the cartels find that it's cheaper to use fentanyl, which gets you a bigger high. So even when people OD, they OD more, and then other people want that fentanyl when they hear they OD because they want the bigger high. But days later, something else emerged. They interviewed the people in the hospital, and they all thought they were buying cocaine. And it turned out yesterday they unsealed the federal complaint. They're buying from dealers they've been buying from for years. Like 50, one guy had gone 50 times to the same dealer. And he said, here's some cocaine. And fentanyl looks like cocaine. It's white powder, but it's a completely different kind of drug. It's an opioid that brings you down rather than up. And they, no one, and the cops told me, the U.S. Attorney, they hadn't seen anything like this anywhere else where people were passing cocaine off, fentanyl off as cocaine. And obviously, that's deadly. It's even dangerous for police to handle the fentanyl when they confiscate it. So that is their mystery now, is whether these dealers were the ones responsible for passing it off that way, or whether it was the source, their source of drugs, that was passing off fentanyl as cocaine. And if that's a new trend, that is deadly.
And it also, it points to another issue here. Almost the entire supply of Narcan, naloxone, the drug that's used by first responders to bring people back from overdoses, basically had to go outside the city, Paul, to get more because so much was being used.
Yep, they got to the end of their supply in one night. And until now, you hadn't heard about it as much in New Haven. It was more of a rural phenomenon, a suburban phenomenon, white people and heroin. We always had heroin here, but the new kind of opioid crisis. And I think what was interesting, different, we saw it with the first major overdose that actually was cocaine buyers.
It was cocaine buyers, and this Narcan should be a one dose to bring people back. In some cases,
five
doses to actually bring people back. There's some reporting coming up later on this week from WNPR's Ryan Karen King, actually about people who are attempting to get more Narcan into the hands of users directly because they're the ones who are on the scene more so than even first responders.
One person was talking about some parties people are having now where they have Narcan at the parties, and they deliberately get themselves to the point where they need it. It's weird.
It's something that we'll be continuing to follow in the New Haven Independent. We've got just a few minutes left, and we try at the end of the program to bring up a few stories that maybe aren't on our radar. You know, Kyle already brought up mine, so I'll just say quickly, you know, the Hartford fireworks display, the fact that the city can't pay for fireworks, the Hartford current editorial board writes about this. They say, when it comes to setting priorities, municipal leaders naturally have to focus on the essential needs of their residents before indulging in the luxuries, no matter how patriotic. But such luxuries can endear visitors and residents, especially younger ones, to a community. They are great PR, so bring back the fireworks. Kalila, what are you thinking?
Totally agree. So I'm focused on Brian France, who leads NASCAR. Again, I'm showing my Southern roots, who will now be speaking at the Republican National Convention this summer. France came into attack last year because he wanted to distance NASCAR from the Confederate flag. So I think his choice of speaking at this convention is the party's way of saying, look, we are in touch. We can debate that on another show.
I was going to say, I mean, that may be the one thing you're talking about. This is the first time I think anybody's ever talked about NASCAR on not just on the Wheelhouse, but maybe on the radio on WNPR.
I'm happy to make that contribution.
Very nice. Matt, how about you?
Possibly on NPR nationally. This may be the first time.
We break barriers here.
Yeah.
How about you, Matt?
So my quick advice to listeners, if you're looking for a quick 8-hour diversion, O.J. Made in America is a spectacular documentary. Watch it both for the content, if it interests you, but even just as a work of art, just the use of music, the filming, absolutely enticing. I was flipping channels. My wife was away. It's just like, can I watch on TV? The first 3 minutes of it had me completely hooked, just absolutely haunting. So that's my contribution for the week.
And one thing I've asked people who've talked about, because I've not watched it yet, is do you learn something new about this entire world and all of these intertwined stories than you knew before?
I was in L.A. for part of the O.J. trial. I covered it for a week. And I learned things, some of the history. I'm only two parts of the five into it. Things I absolutely had not known about O.J.'s background, some of his college career, but also kind of on the criminal side. We haven't gotten to the deaths yet. But it is absolutely revealing, even in something covered as significantly as that was.
How about you, Paul? Anything to bring to the table for us before we end the show?
Idiocracy. It's my favorite political movie ever.
It's a great movie.
Satire. I think it is called this election like no other reporter. Like no other article. It's a 2006 movie by the Beavis and Butthead people. It stars Luke Wilson and Maya Rudolph. I loved it when it came out. It's my family's cult hit. But I really think it predicted Donald Trump. It predicted Fox News hegemony. And it figured the way that our political discussion has gone nuts. So if you really want to crack up and have a great time before you jump out of the window about what's happened to our political discourse, watch this movie because it's worth it.
Well, it's interesting. So this is a movie I've not seen, and people have told me about it, so I will go out and see it. And you think it actually gets something right about today? That's 10 years ago, Paul.
I think it's the most spot-on, deepest political commentary that's been produced at all about what's happening right now.
Well, I'm going to leave you with this. At the beginning of the program, we played some of our news out of context, and the last voice we heard was British Speaker of the House of Commons John Bercow saying, "No, I'm sorry. It's a speech. What I want from you is a one-sentence question." And my one-sentence question to end the program is, what the hell's going on? I truly feel like when I was watching Twitter yesterday and I was hearing about another round of bombings, this time in Istanbul, in a place where I've been, in an airport where I've stood in line, in a city that I do indeed love, a place that I've been like Matt Kaufman has been, I start to think about what this does mean for us as a people, and not just as an American, because we often try to bring it right home. But this is as a global citizen. I mean, an awful lot of what we talked about around the Brexit vote is whether or not people want to live in a world in which people who aren't like them get a chance to come and visit their city, and they get to go to other places to learn about the world as well. You sort of feel like you want to be able to see the rest of the world and not have to fear these things. There's nothing really to draw from that other than what the hell's going on. I want to thank Matt Kaufman, investigative reporter for the Hartford Current. Thank you, Matt, for all your work.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks also to Kalila Brown-Dean, Associate Professor of Political Science at Quinnipiac University. Always good to see you, Kalila.
Thanks so much.
Thanks to Paul Bass, editor of the New Haven Independent and Grand Poobah of WNHH. Thanks, Paul.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Tucker Ives produces our program. Thanks so much to Lydia Brown. I'm John Dankosky.